Hey guys, how's it going? All right, well, good. Welcome to the show. See, the people who listen to the whole show archive later on, they hear the minus version without the bumper music. And so each and every time they wonder, why does it take him so long to get started at the beginning, all this dead air? But no, it's not dead air to the live audience. They can hear Ricky's theme by the Beastie Boys. It entertains them between my breaths. All you archive listener folk who don't get to hear it due to copyright purposes and crap. All right, well, anyway. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Man, I was reading Andrew Coburn right up to the wire here, the Onion Radio News. So I'm behind, so let me blog it while I tell it to you at the same time. Today's show, Andrew Coburn, Patrick's brother, see? And also Jeffrey K. And that's 12 to 2 Eastern, you see? And the thing about that is, Andrew Coburn, he's a great journalist, man. I love reading this guy. He writes for Harper's nowadays. And he just sent me his brand new one that's coming out in a month and a half or something. Well, no, I guess the January issue is probably going to hit the shelves there pretty soon, right? Andrew Coburn on the new Cold War with Russia, and I promise you, you're going to want to hear this. And then also Jeffrey K., he's an anti-torture psychologist. Unlike all the pro-torture psychologists, which is basically all of them, because, of course, their entire professional association was so eager to participate in a big government program like torturing people, to endorse and approve and try to rub up against and get some credibility from being partly associated with... Well, you know, the psychiatrists can prescribe drugs, and that makes the psychologists not feel very good about themselves sometimes. And so, in order to benefit their self-esteem, sometimes they like to join into torture programs with the government so they can say, ha, 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 we don't have a Hippocratic oath like you. We can torture people if we want, and that makes us better than you, psychiatrists. Because, of course, there's really no such thing as grown adult human beings, see? Humans are just monkeys, and the adult ones are just tall children is all they are. Tiny little children. And anyway, so, yeah, that's the real world. But not Jeffrey K. Why, he's civilized. Unlike the professional American psychological associations, plural of America, all of them. He's a civilized human being. He's against torture, and he's going to explain a little bit about the torture program and the history behind it and things like this. So that should be really good for you. Also, remind me. No, don't remind me. I'm going to get 10,000 tweets now. After the show today, I'm going to be on Tom Wood's show. Well, he pre-records them kind of thing, you know, for his podcast there. And so Tom Woods is going to be interviewing me about the torture report. So I guess it's a good time for me to review what I think I learned from it and what I think is most important to mention. As I've said before, New Haven, Connecticut, from the Skull and Bones Crypt, a call is coming in there. That's interesting. Hey, guys. Well, that's what the caller ID says. As I mentioned, I swear I'm going to try to keep this part brief this time. What's most important about the torture report is what's not in there. It's not about the rendition program where they export guys to be tortured to fascist dictatorships like Egypt, Syria, or Libya. And it also doesn't discuss any part of the military program. And it also doesn't discuss anything that the CIA didn't feel like putting on paper. And I know that that gets into speculation and can't prove a negative and that kind of thing. On the other hand, it was the conservative, former CIA counterterrorism officer, Philip Giraldi, who made that point himself unprovoked by me on this show that, hey, the Senate torture report, they went through the CIA's documents, but so that's just what they put in their documents. Never even mind that the staff went over 6 million documents, 6 million documents to write a 6,000 page report that we got to see a 600 page summary of. That's all full of black magic marker too. Redactions, redactions, redactions. And Giraldi's saying, hell, all the worst stuff they didn't put on paper with their name on it, even under a pseudonym. So you can call it speculation, but I say it's a fair point to make when it's made by him. Sure as hell about that. And so that's what's not in the torture report. And then as far as what's in the torture report, much of it is what we already knew, but so what? It's all the absolute height of criminality. Not illegality, criminality. Well, I mean, illegality too. But the bottom line is, they decided, the way Hirsch paraphrased it, grab whom you must, do what you want. And the message was that we are meaner than you. You might knock down our towers, but we will torture the out of you. And threaten your family members and whatever, whatever, whatever. You call us an evil empire, we'll show you evil empire. We will revel in it. We will, in fact, I got the clip here, don't I? Oh, you've heard it 100 times of Cheney saying we're going to have to embrace the dark side to do this. And he didn't just mean, you know, covert operations to secretly spy and hunt down bad guys. He meant turn into bad guys. He meant be bad guys. And in fact, he uses, and I used to have these clips labeled somewhere. I'm going to have to go back and redo this. There's a clip of George Bush saying, well, look, what makes these evil Al-Qaeda guys terrorists is that they're willing to do basically anything to achieve their objective. And then, but that's Dick Cheney's exact words, that we're going to have to embrace the dark side and do things in the shadows in order to achieve our objectives. That's exactly the exact way that Dick Cheney phrased George Bush's policy, is how George Bush puts Al-Qaeda's policy in a nutshell, and they're both exactly right. Just like Jack Hunter today says at, a couple days ago anyway, at rare.com. He said, the people who justify torture sound like Osama bin Laden. Sound just like Osama bin Laden. Here he is saying, yeah, it's okay to kill your civilians. You kill our civilians so we can kill yours. And here Jack Hunter's going, well, look, you know, many of these people were mistaken identity. The guy that they tortured the most of all, they ended up admitting, wasn't even Al-Qaeda at all, Abu Zubaydah. He knew Al-Qaeda guys. He knew that September 11th was going to happen, but he was the furthest thing from their number three guy and keeper of all of their truth and whatever, the way George Bush had betrayed him. And he was the guy they brutalized the most. He was the guy they locked in a coffin for 2 weeks and put insects in there with him, and God knows what they did to him. Left him completely isolated, complete sensory deprivation for months. You know, the Bureau of Prisons reviewed the isolation cells and said, wow, we never thought about isolating people this bad. What fun they must have been thinking, you know. Wow, so you really leave him all the way here in the dark where he can't even hear a sound at all for 3 months, huh? Neat. Yeah. Anyway, and that's, of course, the least of it. The point is they embraced evil deliberately. Torture is terrorism. That's the point. It's the same reason that ISIS tortures people. It's the same reason that ISIS cuts reporters' heads off and massacres Shiites that they capture by the thousands. To terrorize you. It's a force multiplier, see? It's embracing evil. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm really sorry about the website being down and the archives, the podcast being broken and all that crap. What happened was a disc went bad. And Sneaker, the computer genius, had to go back through there and completely copy everything over and do all of this stuff. So it took more than a minute to get everything straight there. It took a couple of days. It's a lot of audio. It's a lot of material on there. So, anyway, point being that I apologize. Another point being that if you... God dang. If I could get it straight here and find the tweet that I'm looking for... Well, I can start, I guess, listing... If you go to my website now, scotthorton.org, you'll be able to find the archives from this week so far on the torture program. The other Scott Horton, Philip Giraldi. God dang, what did I do with this? Oh, here we go. The other Scott Horton, Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler, Jason Leopold, Philip Giraldi, Jonathan Landay, Andy Worthington, Eric Margulies, and Lawrence Wilkerson. Those are the interviews on the torture program just from this week, and then today we'll be adding Jeffrey K to that list. And I'm not sure what's going to be the KPFK show. So subscribe to the podcast feed there. You can get just the interviews, or you can get the whole show archives if you subscribe to the podcast feeds there at scotthorton.org. It's kind of work we do around here. And also, one more thing about that. I got a lot of people emailing me and tweeting me and calling me on the telephone and sending me instant messages. Seriously. Hey, man, what the hell is wrong with the website? Is everything okay? When is it going to be back up again? You got to tell me. And I got to say thank you. It's nice to know that you guys really do like the show. So apparently you really do. There ain't too much of you. The support for the show, it's about a foot wide and 100 miles deep, I guess. That's the way it goes. So, okay, I'll take it. Thanks, guys, for appreciating it and missing it. It's back now, scotthorton.org. And by the way, scotthorton.org/chat if you want to hang out in the chat room and talk with the guys during the show or, you know, before and after, too. Got people hanging out in the chat room all the time there. scotthorton.org/chat. Okay, so now, man, I got so much news to cover, and I got to add another interview today. Tyler Cullis from the NIAC is going to be here, so that means... First of all, it means there's no chance I can hold Andrew Coburn over for an extra segment. Rats. And then it also means that I have no time to talk about other news. I got to get out of the way. So here's everything I know about the torture report in no particular order, just from the notes I took so far. The first thing Obama did was send Brennan out to defend it. Let's see. I talked about what all is not in there. Oh, here, let me list some books. Chain of Command by Seymour Hersh. Torture Team by Philip Sands, A Question of Torture by Alfred McCoy. You know, James Bovard's book, Attention Deficit Democracy, has a great torture section in it. And I'm sorry, I have a whole torture section on my bookshelf. I'm craning my neck looking right now. What the hell's my torture section? There's quite a few of them, and I'm sorry I'm not coming up with them on the top of my head. But if you want to know especially all about the criminal conspiracy to create the torture regime, read Torture Team by Philip Sands. Guilty, guilty, guilty criminals. That's it. Okay. Kenneth Roth from Human Rights Watch said there is no statute on limitations on abuse that could reasonably be believed to possibly lead to death or whatever. I forget the exact words. But in other words, there's no statute of limitations on torture if there's any kind of likelihood that they could have died during the torture. And so, therefore, prosecute. That's all the legal stuff I have to say. Marcy was on and talked about just how much they knew it was a crime. The lawyers are just like mob lawyers, helping criminals get around the law, trying to, rather than truly analyzing the law and explaining what's legal and what's not, which makes them all criminals there. There never was a single ticking time bomb scenario, not one. Oh, my God, we have to torture this guy or else L.A. is going to get nuked. Blah, blah, blah. Never happened, not once. Not used to disrupt a single plot, ever. And, in fact, all 20 of them that they said were all debunked. Just like when they said, we have 52 cases where NSA, illegal warrantless surveillance of the American people, stopped attacks. And then they went through and they analyzed. The president's own appointed commissions went through and analyzed and said, no, there's one case of a San Diego cab driver sent some money to Al-Shabaab. Get the hell out of here. Same thing here. They claimed 20 different times. Uh-huh. Look how many times that we stopped the plot. And the Senate staff went through and said, no, you guys already knew that 7 months before. It says so right here in this email and this report and whatever. They found it and they debunked it 20 times. And they also documented that tons of bogus crap was produced. Do you remember 2002? Are you old enough to remember? Are you willing to remember 2002 and early 2003? Orange alert. As far as we know, there's Al-Qaeda everywhere here in North America. They're everywhere. They're going to blow up your school. They're going to blow up your bank. They're going to blow up your everything. Oh, my God, we just got word. There's another impending Al-Qaeda attack. The terror level alert has been raised to orange again. They were lying. They were torturing those bogus claims out of people. That's where they were getting that crap. It was all a bunch of crap. And it was on the level of, yeah, Al-Qaeda one time in 1994, Ramzi bin al-Shib said, hey, man, maybe we should, like, bomb a bank. That's it. Somebody had mentioned at the Malaysia meeting that the library tower in L.A. might be a target. But they never planned that. They never included that. That was never part of the planes operation of 9/11. It never had anything to do with anything. It was just some old bogus thing. And George Bush came right out. And, of course, he called it the Liberty Tower because he never knows what the hell he's talking about. It's the library tower in Los Angeles. And, no, there was not a plot against it that was disrupted at all. It was something that one Al-Qaeda nut had said to another once and meant nothing and didn't come from, the information didn't come from torture anyway. So just for example, 100 orange alerts, all a bunch of crap. Many of them tortured out of people. Also, the bosses routinely overrode the actual torturers, and I guess the guys overseeing the torturers and whatever on the ground there, saying, okay, this guy really has had it and has told us everything. Trust us. And the bosses said, nope. You know, it's a political decision being made from higher than them that you will continue torturing this guy until we say quit or until he says Saddam Hussein or something. Just keep on at it. After the torturers themselves are saying, hey, you know, I'll torture a guy to death. I don't care. But, geez, boss, you should know that really, I swear to you, there's no point. Don't torture me or anything. I'm just saying there's no point in torturing this guy anymore because he's all tortured out, dude. You know, huh? No, boss has overruled that over and over again. As I mentioned, Zubaydah, 2 weeks in a coffin, including with insects, had him trained like a little puppy where the torture would raise an eyebrow and Abu Zubaydah would jump up onto the waterboard to be tortured, to spare him being absolutely beaten within an inch of his life before being waterboarded. He would just go ahead like, you couldn't even I don't know. Yeah. They sure learned helplessness and all that. That it's effective, not getting truth out of anything. But yes, it is possible to break a human being. Mitchell and Jessen sure as hell prove that. They exclude Penny Lane in the murder case that other Scott Horton has done so much great work on. We're going to find out more about that soon. Of course, as you know, you've heard in the media lots and lots of ass rape, unlimited amounts. Must be a Cheney family thing. Families threatened. They kidnapped the mentally deficient relative of one of their prisoners to torture, to get at him. Shades of the John Yoo hypothetical question right there.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And haven't I told you guys 100 times you ought to read Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy by Andrew Coburn? Yeah, of course I have. I quote it all the time. I quote him all the time. It's such a great book, and there's one very important point, well, that stands out to me that I always go back to, and that is, Andrew, your phraseology that in the book that the neoconservative movement is really where the Israel lobby meets the American military-industrial complex. I guess the bankers and the oil men, they already had their Council on Foreign Relations, but all the arms manufacturers, they needed a few of their own. And so they made a deal with the Israel lobby to create all these think tanks and lie us into war all the time. Is that about it? Welcome
That's
to the, back
it.
To the
yeah,
show.
You know, the,
how's that for an introduction?
You got it right. You know, it the Israel lobby traditionally was, you know, like kind of a peacenik on everything except Israel, like they were anti-Vietnam and so forth. And there actually was a gentleman called Paul Nitzer, who was one of the great Cold Warriors, who saw in the 1970s if you could put the Israel lobby together with the defense lobby, you were home free, because then you'd have the Israel lobby weighing in. And in fact, it worked so well, within a few short years, the Anti-Defamation League was saying that to criticize the defense budget was anti-Semitic.
That's funny. Just because so many people from the Israel lobby and the neoconservative movement, they just had such a lock on that point of view that we must increase defense spending at all times, that it was perceived to be a Jewish point of view, at least if you dared to disagree with it, right?
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, they were on the payroll. And like Paul Wolfowitz was, I mean, he was pulling down a lot of big money from Hughes Aircraft, I remember. You know, Rumsfeld had defense stocks all over the place. So, you know, as usual, it all came down to money.
Right on. Well, so, yeah, I was really reminded of that. And people can go, again, the book is Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. And there's so much stuff in there, guys. You just trust me. Go get it. Now, the brand new one is for Harper's Magazine, and I guess I could have figured out what exactly your title is there. Could you tell me?
Game On.
Oh, yeah. No. I meant you. You're a contributing editor.
My title. I'm Washington editor of Harper's Magazine.
Washington editor. That's the term I was searching for there, Harper's Magazine. There we go. And, yes, Game On, East versus West again, and this is in the January issue, correct?
Correct, yeah. Right. But it's you can get it now. I mean, you can get it online now, at least, and you can subscribe and get all sorts of good things. Yeah.
Okay, great. So that's, again, harpers.org and your local bookstand. Game On, East versus West, again, the rise of the new Cold War. There's a brand new article today in Newsweek about Mikhail Gorbachev complaining about the rise of the new Cold War and just how unnecessary it all is and just how much it's all America's fault, which is hardly disputable at all. But you really do us a great service in this article, Andrew, in the way that you go back to the end of the Cold War and the very tough position that the military-industrial complex found itself in and what they set about to do about it.
Well, right. I mean, they, you know, it was terrible. They'd lost the enemy. They'd lost the hand that fed them for so many years, which was, you know, the Soviet threat, the Russian bear that was going to, you know, going to invade and take over Europe and the rest of the world, and that's why we had to go on spending billions and billions to fend that off. And suddenly, no Soviet threat. What to do? So what they did was they, you know, the Cold War was meant to be over, but they set to work to get it going again. You know, if you remember, there was a very nice period of around 1990-91 when we all thought the Cold War was over, you know, and Russia was our friend, and we were demobilizing and taking nuclear weapons out of Europe, and, you know, the Russians were moving out of Eastern Europe, and we're all going to be friends. But then suddenly we start hearing, we won the Cold War, and we've got to keep Russia down, and we have to move NATO eastward. And that was the initiative. That was the guarantee that you would, sooner or later, you would have renewed tension and confrontation. And, you know, guess what? The guy very much running that for after a while was a vice president of the Lockheed Martin Defense Corporation, the biggest in the world, Bruce Jackson, who set up and ran the committee to expand NATO. I mean, it was all presented as some highfalutin, you know, exercise in diplomacy, but really it was to the benefit of the Lockheed Corporation and others like them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. I never can quite put my finger on exactly how this goes. I talked with John Mearsheimer on the show after he wrote his article for Foreign Affairs saying
right.
it was the Americans who picked this fight. And his point of view is that intellectuals with their doctrines picked this fight because they believe that, you know, what Bill Clinton calls free markets and democracy, right? Not what Murray Rothbard would call free markets, but the American Empire version of spreading our goodness to the world, you know, the end of history kind of thing, that just this ideology of American goodness and that of course, expanding the EU means, of course, expanding NATO and keep on expanding it. And it comes like with this very kind of unbearable lightness of being a public policy intellectual and that it has so very little to do with Lockheed or very little to do with hating Russia and wanting to destroy it or any kind of thing like that. It's he talks about it like it's almost a schoolboy naivete, which he sounds the same way himself as he describes it. So I wonder just how much of that is at play. Is it really just,
smart guys? I disagree with him a bit. I mean, he's right in a way. There were some sort of firebrand intellectuals, if that isn't a tautology, there was a guy called Ron Asmus, who's dead now, but he was like a big proponent and he pushed very hard and lobbied in the bureaucracy quite effectively for expanding NATO, and he, by all accounts, was a kind of a true believer. But most of them, I think people don't do, I don't, you know, as we've discussed before, I don't really believe there is such a thing as foreign policy ever. Mm-hmm. It's always some personal or, general domestic political advantage. You know, Bill Clinton pushed for NATO expansion. And, you know, if you ask the people who, you know, sort of officials, they'll say, oh, well, it's because he was convinced of the rightness of the cause and Vaclav Havel, you know, begged him to do it. Mm-hmm. No, Bill Clinton saw that if he'd have a much better chance of winning Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois and Wisconsin or in 2006, or his chances, you know, would be improved by some measurable amount if he, you know, made nice to the Polish emigre community, the Polish community in those states, which is quite a significant bloc. And so they were all hot for expanding NATO and having Poland in NATO and ditto with the Czechs and some of the others. So he was in favor of expanding NATO. I think that's why things happen, really. Call me cynical. But, Mearsheimer, I mean, I have a lot of respect for John Mearsheimer, and, you know, I agree with a lot of what he said on this issue, but he definitely believes that, you know, that states have a foreign policy. I don't think so. I think politicians have foreign policy, and they do it whatever it is for their own advantage.
Right. Yeah, well, and in fact, in the article, the way you relate that anecdote is it's Brzezinski, who is the closest thing we supposedly have to one of these, old graybeards, selfless, yeah. Brilliant, old enough to not be self-interested in any way, kind of statesman or whatever the hell. And he was the one who said, you're going to lose Polish votes. That was the way he put it to Bill.
That's right. You know, and it's obviously good for Brzezinski if he's, you know, a big player. And maybe, I guess, there's a bit of, you know, emotion in there, too. He's a sort of fanatical Polish nationalist, so that probably came, I'm sure that came into play. But, yeah, you know, that's the way it worked. Bruce Jackson will tell you, and he certainly told me with an absolutely straight face, that his work to expand NATO was purely, you know, disinterested of public service. He thought it was the right thing for Europe and had to keep America. It was really a way of warding off American isolationists.
The consequences on the other side of this break with Andrew Coburn from Harpers.org. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Andrew Coburn about Lockheed's foreign policy, NATO expansion. And, you know, it's funny, I think Richard Cummings wrote about Bruce Jackson years ago in a great piece for Playboy.com, and he quoted him talking just the same way you've got him here, Andrew, saying, oh, no, man, I really just believe in the beauty of NATO expansion. It has nothing to do with my affiliation with Lockheed at all, except NATO expansion, in essence, means standardize your Air Force with our Air Force with Lockheed products, and that's basically all it means, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, and it's and go on, you know, and you've got to go on buying our spare parts forever and ever, and you know, you bankrupt yourselves in the process. Yeah, that was the main point of NATO expansion. And it was also to stop the Germans getting any ideas about, you know, becoming any kind of leading an independent Europe.
And there was talk for a while, wasn't there, about an EU army? I remember Thatcher denouncing it and saying, no, we have an alliance with the Americans, and that comes first, and the rest of y'all show up.
Right. I mean, the Americans were always very keen to put us, always made sure that didn't happen, because a European army, European Defense Force means a European weapons procurement means them buying European much more than they do now and not buying American. That's, you know, that's what it all comes down to. That's why, you know, it's very important to keep NATO in there and keep NATO, you know, ruling the roost as so far as defense and weapons buying is concerned.
Mm-hmm. And then you talk about how in 1999, when they went to war with Serbia for Kosovo, for the Kosovo Liberation Army, let's go ahead and be specific, That the whole attitude there of, you know, just F Russia, it doesn't matter what they think or anything like that. It seems to me like at least some of these guys would pose as one of these so-called, you know, graybeard types who can think beyond next week and wonder, well, what is this going to mean for our relationship with Russia? When at the time there was a little bit of talk about, you know, they had their NATO-Russia Council and they were trying to pretend that it was, or maybe they're being realistic. It's about Polish votes and airplanes. It's not so much about continuing the Cold War with you guys. It just looks like it. But then they go and wage this war, and on top of all the NATO expansion and all the arms sales and all that kind of thing, it just seems amazing that, I mean, was there no one up there is any smarter than Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Polish nationalist. No one up there is willing to say, now, wait a minute, there's airplane sales and re-election funds and everything, but there's also the future history of mankind here, and we're not right. going to throw away the end of the Cold War just for some F-16 sales. Come on.
Yeah, well, it's true. It is always amazing how irresponsible and sort of shallow they are, that they really, you know, these, you know, we've all been growing up, you know, we spent years and years now sort of dumping on the Bush people and subsequently Obama. But let's not forget the culpability of the Clinton administration. They were the ones, Madeleine Albright and, you know, her buddies were the ones who really pushed us into, you know, pushed the U.S. and Europe into this war in Kosovo, which was what really convinced the Russians that, hey, the Cold War is not over. They're out to get us, and you can really date the real sort of hardening of Russian attitudes from that point on. And everything that happened since has only gone to reinforce that. I will say that in Georgia, when we were sort of like heedlessly encouraging this maniac in charge that was in charge in Georgia, Mr. Saakashvili, to like provoke the Russians, and, you know, we would say we were going to let him into, you know, indicating that we were going to let him into NATO. Condoleezza Rice went to Tbilisi and sort of said, we stand by our allies. And he then starts a war with Russia. At that point, common sense did prevail. And they said, wait a minute, we're not going to have World War III over this. And, you know, pulled back and didn't reinforce him. But, you know, that was a bit late in the day.
Yeah, well, and it's credibly reported that Dick Cheney did call for strikes, but that Bush said, who agrees with the vice president? Okay, thanks, Dick. But
yeah,
that he
right.
did want to, you know, if say, Bush had hit his head a little harder on that table when he ate that pretzel or something, Cheney would have gone ahead and taken the opportunity to get into a war with Russia in 2008, apparently.
Right, and the Russians, you know, I mean, I've heard this subsequent to writing the article, that the Russians were convinced that they expected the Americans to maybe, you know, NATO to take action. But it was so important to them to, you know, to deal with that situation in the Caucasus that they went ahead. So we came nearer to war, possibly nearer to war at that point than people realized.
Yeah.
It was a very dangerous moment and really brought on by total irresponsibility. Yeah, Cheney had a guy in Tbilisi. I suppose I better not say who it was, but he had a trusted sort of national security aide.
No, go ahead and say who it was.
What?
Go ahead and say who it was.
Well, I believe it was a guy called Joe Wood, who was in Tbilisi at the time, who was, you know, at least this is the story I've heard, was encouraging Saakashvili to, you know, saying, don't worry, we'll back you up. And Saakashvili went ahead. So, a very dangerous, scary moment that was.
Yeah, yeah, really incredible. And, I learned a couple of things there from you. One of them on that particular issue in the article, one of them was that Bush and Stephen Hadley had personally warned Saakashvili in April of 2008, that spring, to not do this. And then he went ahead anyway, made me wonder about that story, which was rumored back then in 2008, too, about a back channel to Cheney's guys that had encouraged him to go ahead and do it.
Right. Well, it was all, I mean, Bush and Hadley at the Bucharest NATO conference, they say, don't do this. You know, we're not going to go to war on your behalf. Then in July, Condoleezza Rice went to Georgia. Privately, she said to Saakashvili, hey, you know, don't do this. You know, you really mustn't start a war. But in public, she gave a sort of public, you know, presentation, press conference, and she said, we stand by our allies. Well, Saakashvili chose to believe that one rather than what she'd said to him in private. It was like,
yeah.
You remember April Glaspie, you know, giving Saddam the idea was in okay to invade Kuwait. Well, this was Condoleezza Rice's Glaspie moment. And so that's what Saakashvili wanted to believe, and he had, you know, Cheney's guy egging him on. So, and Cheney, I mean, as I think I say in the piece, that for Cheney was win-win. Either, actually, I didn't say this in the piece, but this is what I believe. If, say, Georgia attacks Russia and by some miracle wins, well, that's great. You know, we've humbled Russia. If he loses, more likely, but then still great, because now Russia is exposed as this evil Goliath and great big bully crushing
right.
a small country.
Which
so
was the
lose.
Entire, yeah, that was the entire narrative in that summer and fall, and even during the presidential debate. There was even a great moment where Tom Brokaw was hosting the debate between Obama and McCain. And McCain accused Russia of starting the war, and Obama went along with it. And then you could tell, like, the body language, Brokaw making eye contact with the both of them in turn, and the decision kind of agreed upon that, okay, so we're going to go with that then. Okay, fine. And he's not going to dispute it, and we're just going to all three, for the purposes of this debate between presidential candidates, we're going to pretend that it was the Russians who started the war. And not the Georgians. And it was just kind of an amazing moment because you could tell all three were lying and all three knew they were lying and all three were secretly lying in concert with each other right there blatantly in front of everybody. You know what I mean? It was great.
Fantastic. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the New York Times admitted, oh yeah, you know what? We did get that wrong at the end of November 08, right? Months later. They go, oh, you know what? Turns out it was Georgia after all started.
Yeah, exactly so. But, you know, I mean, this is life and death we're talking about. I mean, how incredibly irresponsible just all down the line. I remember Biden, you know, McCain was at the time, and he was calling for armed intervention in Georgia, and I think Biden chimed in, too. I mean, it was like, you know, this scary tub-thumping that goes on.
Right. Well, and now, so in our current situation, this is, of course, where the article begins. It's the news of the last year with the American-backed coup in Ukraine and then Russia's counter move in taking back the Crimean Peninsula for the Russian Federation there. And, you know, I forget now if this was... this is recently, right, in the last couple of years where they had a big meeting with the military-industrial complex and they were absolutely euphoric. Yeah, borderline euphoric.
Well, that's right.
Current outbreak of tension here.
That's right. It was just after, you know, the Russians took over Crimea, I mean. And a friend of mine who's a lobbyist, happened to be at a meeting, a fundraiser for Mike Rogers, who's, at least was at the time, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Whoops, sorry about this. chairman of the Intelligence Committee. And I was talking to him the next day, and I said, oh, what was it like? And he said, well, most of the people there were defense contractor lobbyists. Well, it's not what my friend does, but he said, yeah, they people there from the defense companies. And I said, well, what were they talking? What was the mood? And he said, oh, well, considering what's going on, I'd call it borderline euphoric. Yeah. They were just so happy that, you know, that the Cold War was, you know, was heating up again.
Yeah. Scare the hell out of them, Harry. Go out there and...
Right, because, as I say in the piece, you know, things have been a bit bleak for the defense industry in the last year or so with this, you know, the hated sequester, you know, the possibility, which was, you know, threatened to cut the defense budget back to what it was in 2007 when we were actually fighting two wars, and they just, you know, the thought of going back to that paltry level is completely unbearable for them, so they're desperate for a way out of this.
I like Lou Rockwell's idea. He says we should pay all these people, all the government employees and all the defense contractors, we should all pay them $1 million a year to just go on vacation to Bermuda, right? You can't take it all away from them or they'll kill us all. So
that's
just pay them to go on vacation and please leave us alone, you know?
That's an excellent idea. Yeah, be quite good. Yeah, you know, the U.S. government won't pay ransom to terrorists, but we should.
Yeah, exactly. And be rid of them once and for all. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time. I've already kept you over time, but a great bit of work here again, as always, there, Andrew.
Okay. Thanks very much, Scott. Anytime.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all. That's Andrew Coburn. And the new piece is Game On, East versus West. Again, rise to the new Cold War here. It's Andrew Coburn in Harper's Magazine on your shelves and by subscription at their website, harpers.org. We'll be right back with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Yeah, one of them things finally made me laugh for a change there. All right, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Welcome back to it.
Yes, the website, it's fixed. So it's a true statement when I say full interview archives are there for you at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. And actually got a note from a guy said he's about halfway through them all now. That's a lot of me. You sure about that? All right. Well, if you say so, man. Next up is Tyler Cullis. He's at the National Iranian American Council over there with Trita and Reza, doing work to promote peace between America and Iran. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Tyler?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Very happy to have you here, and very happy to be running your piece, A Cautionary Tale, as the spotlight article today on antiwar.com. I think it's a very important one, and that's why I made it the spotlight. A Cautionary Tale, How the Mistaken... I really shouldn't bang my mouse on the table while I'm talking for emphasis. How the mistaken claims of one hawkish think tank put at risk the prospects for a nuclear deal. So I guess let me just sum up real quick. We're in the middle of still working on a final nuclear deal, but we've been, the IAEA has reported a lot of really good progress on implementing the interim agreement reached a year ago, November, and they had another extension, so they didn't succeed this November, but they're still working on it. And you're saying here that there's this think tank in Washington, D.C. that's throwing a monkey wrench in the works. So give us the lowdown.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, on November 24th was the final date for the latest round of talks. And, you know, John Kerry stepped up to the podium with the unfortunate news that a deal hadn't been struck, but that there would be an extension. But he made clear that Iran had implemented its side of the agreement the day after the IAEA released its monthly report on the matter, saying the same thing. Iran has fully upheld its side of the interim deal. But on November, but right after that, what you saw is you saw Bret Stephens, the neocon at the Wall Street Journal, saying that Iran had cheated on its obligations. AIPAC put out a statement calling for new sanctions, saying the same thing. On December 8th, the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ed Royce, said that two separate studies had shown that Iran had violated the terms of the interim deal. And all of these claims stem from the work of one organization, the Institute for Science and International Security, which is David Albright's group. And David Albright's claim stems from the IAEA's quarterly report on November 7th. In that report, in the morass of technical details, there is one line that says Iran had intermittently fed uranium hexafluoride into an advanced IR-5 centrifuge, a single machine centrifuge. And Albright quickly released his own analysis on the same day, November 7th, saying that this was a possible violation, an apparent violation. He alternates between the two claims. So very quickly, I wanted to know the basis for the claim, because Albright had not hinted at any text within the interim deal suggesting that this was a violation. The basis of Albright's claim is footnote one of the joint plan of action, which he let me know on Twitter. And footnote one of the joint plan of action says Iran will not feed uranium hexafluoride into the centrifuges installed but not enriching uranium. According to Albright, the IR-5 was installed but not enriching uranium, according to the IAEA's February report, and therefore this was a centrifuge that should not have been enriching uranium. The problem with that is that footnote one refers to the Natanz fuel enrichment plant. The IR-5 that was fed uranium hexafluoride, however, is located at the Natanz pilot fuel enrichment plant, which is an entirely separate nuclear facility. So what Albright had done is he had mistakenly read the joint plan of action to transfer an obligation imposed on one of Iran's nuclear facilities to an entirely different one. And the obligation imposed on Iran is on Iran's major centrifuge facility, where Iran has 19,500 centrifuges, around 10,000 of them are operating. So it would make sense for the footnote one to refer to that facility. The Natanz pilot fuel enrichment plant is an entirely separate facility that engages in R&D work. And Iran is very concerned about making sure that the P5+1 does not limit its ability to conduct scientific research on advanced centrifuge models. So we wouldn't expect that obligation to be there. And in fact, that's exactly what we find in the joint plan of action. So Albright had, made a totally erroneous reading of the joint plan of action to produce the claim that is now being used by hawks in Washington to push for renewed sanctions and to put at risk a final deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, Tyler, this is all very complicated, and even David Albright, who's made many, many, many honest mistakes, is entitled to make an honest mistake. And so surely he apologized and corrected himself once you informed him of the discrepancies in his footnotes and his accusations, right?
You know, that would have been a lot easier than what has taken place. He changed the nature of his claim. What he did, in fact, is he deleted his tweet stating that the basis for his concern is footnote one of the JCPOA, and started out on an entirely different claim, which is that Iran's feeding uranium hexafluoride into the advanced centrifuge violated the spirit of the agreement. You know, I don't know if he is performing a seance on the joint plan of action, but I'm not sure.
Well, and the way you outline it, doesn't sound like they're in violation of the spirit of the agreement either. It sounds like they had carved out this exception that, hey, when it comes to our research things, the ban on introducing nuclear material into a machine for the first time doesn't count because we got some experiments we want to do. Kerry apparently said that's okay, at least for the interim deal, that would be acceptable. So I don't know. I mean, I guess this is what you say in your article too. Where's the spirit? Where is it implied that the spirit is in contradiction to the actual terms here? It doesn't seem like it at all. It seems like the narrative of the terms being written the way they were necessitates the conclusion that they were meant to be that way.
I mean, what David, you know, ignored is the fact that there is a section pertaining to Iran's R&D activities, and that says that Iran will continue its safeguarded R&D practices, including its current enrichment R&D practices not designed for accumulation of enriched uranium. Iran's feeding the uranium hexafluoride into the advanced IR-5 centrifuge produced no enriched uranium. To be frank, actually, there was an article yesterday by Jaffe Joseph, who used to be the director of nonproliferation on the National Security Council. And under Jaffe's telling, Iran feeding uranium hexafluoride into a single machine tells Iran very little about whether the machine is workable. It needs to connect the machine to an entire cascade to figure out whether the design is right and all kinds of technical details related to it. So even, you know, the implication of Iran's feeding uranium hexafluoride into the advanced centrifuge is, I mean, there's really nothing to it. David has since engaged in, you know, ad hominem attacks on me, claiming that I lack the technical expertise as to this matter, which is an ironic claim because it is a legal matter on how we read the joint plan of action. And me being a lawyer and him not being one, it seems as if there is a disadvantage here. It's David's disadvantage in reading the joint plan of action. You know, this has continued since the article has been published. He continues to engage in ad hominem attacks rather than to retract his claim and correct the record, which would be a much easier approach.
All right. Now, just how severe do you estimate is the threat to the negotiation based on this trumped up nonsense from ISIS?
You know, to some extent, it doesn't take much for many members of Congress to push for new sanctions. But this provides them an excuse. It provides them a convenient way to say, you know, this was exactly in Chairman Royce's statement on December 8th. Look, Iran is, we have a study showing that Iran is in violation of the joint plan of action. How can we trust them to adhere to their obligations under any final comprehensive deal? Why are the negotiators, even in Vienna or now Geneva, talking to Iran? It doesn't matter. Iran's going to cheat. They're a determined cheater. So there's no point to this whole charade. You know, and that's a very dangerous mentality to take here, especially when, you know, according to the United States, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran is adhering to its
obligations. We'll be right back in just a sec, Tyler. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything.
I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Tyler Cullis from the National Iranian American Council. The article is A Cautionary Tale, How the Mistaken Claims of One Hawkish Think Tank Put at Risk the Prospects for a Nuclear Deal. You can find it as the Spotlight article today at antiwar.com. And I'm sorry, Tyler, about the heartbreak there, man. I thought you were going to be able to squeeze that sentence in there, and it didn't quite work out. But I'll let you finish now. You were talking about just how powerful this talking point could amount to be in the hands of the incoming Republicans in Congress and those who would seek to thwart a deal with Iran. And I don't mean to exclude any hawkish Democrats, because there are plenty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people are looking for an excuse to kill this deal, to support a renewed push for sanctions, and claims like David's make it a lot easier for them to do so. And this is troubling at a time in which, according to both the United States, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran is upholding its obligations pursuant to the Joint Fund of Action. This is a troubling situation.
Yeah. All right. And to remind people and wrap up, and for people just tuning in here, the complaint is that they have fed, according to the IAEA, who apparently didn't complain about it or think it was a problem for obvious reasons, according to the IAEA report, they fed some uranium hexafluoride gas into this advanced model centrifuge. And Albright tried to make a big deal about it as though under rules that apply to an entirely different place, an entirely different plant, an entirely different set of centrifuges, the ones that are already running, producing industrial-grade enriched uranium there at the, you know, plain old Natanz facility, not this smaller research facility. And the deal there was you will not add any machines to your cascades that you're running now. You'll leave things as they are and not expand. And then now we're at the point where the Republicans get to say, see what cheaters they are, those dastardly 12th Imam believing fundamentalist Islamist terrorist nuclear bombers. How can we possibly deal with them? The Democrats selling us out again, all that kind of thing. And now they rule both houses of Congress, whereas at least Harry Reid was willing to go along with the president on this. There's no reason to count on that for the upcoming Congress at all, really. So that's a big problem. But now everybody's caught up, if I got that right, Tyler.
No, I mean, that's right. Totally true. I mean, you can actually go back to the November 24th. You know, every month, the IAEA puts out a status update on Iran's implementation of the Joint Plan of Action. Mm-hmm. The same day that the diplomats left Vienna, November 24th, the IAEA confirmed, that's the language, confirmed that Iran has continued its safeguarded R&D practices, including its current enrichment R&D practices, not designed for accumulation of enriched uranium. That language comes precisely from the Joint Plan of Action. The IAEA confirms that Iran has continued its safeguarded R&D practices. No violation was cited in that report.
Yeah, same old, same old. And, you know, I like to mention, and you don't have to because I know people have different takes on this, but I'm a full Gareth Porterian on this issue, that it's an entirely manufactured crisis, that Iran never had a nuclear weapons program at all or any serious intention to develop nuclear weapons, banned as the project was by both Ayatollahs that have ruled the place since 1979, and that all of the so-called evidence, everything David Albright has ever said to David Sanger at the New York Times or what's this copycat over there at the Washington Post or these guys, is always hype. For years, they referred to Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program as though it was just a thing that existed somewhere in time and space, though no one ever asked them to describe what the hell they were talking about, because it just wasn't true. And so I like to drive home the point to my audience that this is a great opportunity to put a huge fake issue to bed. It's an outstanding issue that prevents the end of the American-Iranian Cold War, which is to the detriment of the Iranian people especially, but to the Americans and world peace in general as well. And it's nonsense. So to think that somehow we're going to let one more small little piece of hype from David Albright, who has never been right. He's basically Bill Kristol over there, but on the Iran nuclear issue only, as far as his batting average and all that kind of thing, that we're going to let some false factoid disrupt this most important negotiation when the solutions, in fact, I guess I'll figure out a way to end this in the form of a question about what's even outstanding at this point. It ought to be easy enough to put this thing to bed and move forward and have, I don't want to be allies with Iran, but we can have a peaceful relationship with Iran just like any other state on earth. And so, yeah, that's my sermon on the thing. I don't know if you want to talk about the politics of it at all, but I guess if you're desperate for me to ask you a question at the end of that rant, it would be, what's outstanding between, never mind Albright, but between Kerry and Larijani here and these guys to be worked out?
Yeah, I mean, there's two major issues. One is the size and scope of Iran's enrichment program. And the second one is the size and scope of Iran's sanctions relief. And these two things need to be traded against each other. And both parties have so far been more interested or more concerned about maintaining leverage over the term of a final deal rather than making the compromises necessary to get to a deal in the first place. I mean, to be honest, I think pushing back against claims like David's is so important because, you know, the negotiators left Vienna being very optimistic about their ability to reach a final deal. I think that Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif have built a real rapport over the past 12 months. I think they genuinely like each other. I think they have come to an understanding with each other, even if they have political disagreements that remain. But, you know, I'm optimistic about their opportunities to get a deal within the next 7 months, and I think it's going to be a lot sooner than that. And I think the negotiators are optimistic as well. I think those two outstanding issues can be resolved, provided that a little more time is spent and a little more compromise is made by both sides.
Yeah. Well, and now, so what all more compromising do the Iranians have left to do? Because the sanctions seems like America owes them the relief, from my point of view, for what they've already been willing to give up, and as far as, you know, the numbers of centrifuges and that kind of thing. I guess it's not only because of my bias that I'm not worried about them ever even trying to break out, because I don't think that's what they want to do anyway, but it seems like, you know, the Kerry's got to kind of understand that too, that really they're trying to maintain their program for their energy needs, partially because of how isolated we've made them in the first place, requires this energy program, and for a political statement internally for their own politics about their independence from the will of the Americans who have pushed them around for so long and all that kind of thing. It seems like both of those things you just named are both places for Kerry to give rather than them. But what more do you think they could do?
I mean, I think it's a matter of political expediency for both sides. I mean, to be honest, I think if neither one of the parties had a domestic audience at home, that there would have been an agreement by now. I think what we're really doing is they're negotiating with each other and negotiating with hardliners that they face back home. I think from the U.S.'s perspective, there needs to be long enough of a breakout time, no matter how arbitrary that timeline is, to make sure that it takes Iran at least 12 months before it can develop enough weapons-grade uranium for one bomb. And from the Iranian perspective, there needs to be actual sanctions relief. And the U.S. has been unwilling thus far to provide the significant sanctions relief that will, in turn, ensure that Iran provides, you know, compromises on elements of its nuclear program as well. You know, both sides need a political win in order to be able to sell this at home. And to that extent, I'm sympathetic to both positions. But I think there's areas for compromise here. I think there's ways for each side to get what it wants under a final deal and for each side to be able to sell that deal at home.
Well said. Well, I sure appreciate your optimism, and I'm trying very hard to share it, Tyler. I sure would like to see this issue put to bed. And I do agree with you. It does seem clear that John Kerry really wants to do this thing. I don't know whether he's going to finally actually do it or not. But, you know, it's not just, you know, another kind of pretension like the negotiations of 03 through 05, that kind of thing. I mean, this is a real effort. It would be a real shame for it to fall apart. So I agree with you. That's why I got you on. That's why I'm running your article as the spotlight today on antiwar.com. is because I agree that there has to be pushback on every bit of this false narrative seeking to undermine this thing. It's of such great importance. So thank you very much for your work here. Of course, the article and your time on the show today. I appreciate it.
No, thanks. Thanks for sharing it, and thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. That's Tyler Cullis. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org, NIAcouncil.org. And we'll be right back with Jeffrey Kay right after this. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back. Poor Tyler Cullis, what a way to be interviewed, huh? Oh, well. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Next up is Jeffrey Kay. He's a psychologist who lives in the Bay Area and writes for Fire Dog Lake Dissenter. FireDogLake.com there with Kevin Godstola. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Let me page down. Let me see if I can find your whole bio somewhere on this page. It has all this stuff about... I'll tell you what. I'll just ask you.
Sure.
Could you tell us, please, about how you used to work with torture victims and this kind of thing, your experience with this topic in your professional life?
Sure, yeah. I'm a psychologist. I've been in practice now for 15 years, a little more. And I used to work for a while with an organization, Survivors International in San Francisco. It's one of a torture treatment center, and one of a number of them in this country, treating victims of torture from abroad, many of them who fled regimes, some of them supported by the United States, who come here to get political asylum or for one reason or another have ended up here and are trying to recover from the terrible physical and emotional, psychological wounds that torture inflicts on a human being. And today, I'm not actually working with survivors anymore. I'm just in private practice in San Francisco, and I have been researching and writing for some years now on the topic of torture, U.S. torture in particular.
Right. Yeah, it's very important that we have your point of view on this subject and have your journalism as a professional psychologist. And speaking of that, you know what, before we get to the latest in the torture report and Mitchell and Jessen and all that, well, Mitchell and Jessen's part of this, I want to go back to your article from the 7th, APA Independent Torture Review, led by attorney who worked with CIA's tenet. So this is the APA, that's the American Psychological Association. Why do they need an independent torture review? What's going on there?
Well, New York Times reporter James Risen came out with a book last month, Annie Price, in which he looks at the costs in terms of corruption and politically the cost of the war on terror and just how amped up it was and how it was used as a gravy train for all sorts of corruption and abuses of all sorts. And one chapter in the book looks at how organized psychology, particularly the American Psychological Association, or top members of it, worked with the military and the CIA because the latter wanted to use psychologists for interrogations, which we, many of which, as we later were to learn, in fact, was to teach them how to torture. And they utilized techniques taken from a military training program called SEER that is used to inoculate people against the stress of being tortured. Anyway, there's been a long controversy about this, and Risen revealed some new information in his book that showed, in fact, there was this collaboration, emails were passed back and forth, et cetera. And the APA felt stung enough by this. And I also believe that they were worried enough about what might be in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report on the CIA that they kind of in a, what I see personally as a PR move, but others see, who oppose torture, see as at least some kind of genuine attempt to get to the bottom of this. And they constructed what they call an independent review. They, on their own, went out and contracted with a Chicago attorney by the name of David Hoffman, who was not affiliated to the American Psychological Association, independent. And then they assigned three of their own top members from their board of directors to be the people who Hoffman answers to. And Hoffman right now is conducting such a review of whether or not the APA or its top members colluded with the military and the CIA in constructing Bush's so-called enhanced interrogation or torture program. And what I wrote in my article was that I just said, like anyone else, let's sit down and look who's involved in this review. Let's research it, and like any journalist should. But unfortunately, none of the journalists have, including at First Looks The Intercept or Forbes Online or The New York Times, or anyone who's written about this review that the APA undertook, and discovered that the man leading it, David Hoffman, had... yes, many years ago, 20 years ago, worked in the offices of Senator David Boren, who was at that time the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. In other words, he was doing the same job that today Feinstein is doing, at least in terms of organizationally. And at the same time in that office, the staff director of the Senate Select Committee, the person who heads up the bureaucracy of that committee, was a man by the name, and you probably recognize it, or your listeners will, named George Tenet, who, of course, within a matter of years afterwards, became the leader of the CIA, the head of the CIA. And there was another guy there who became Tenet's attorney by the name of Ken Levitt, who also was in this, later to join the CIA. And you know, Hoffman was privy to in that office and admitted that he knew Tenet and Levitt and worked with them, including as a spokesman anyway, for things that the Senate committee was doing that were classified, and spoke out for Boren and the committee's support of Robert Gates to be head of the CIA, for instance. I don't know all the things Hoffman did there. The point being, he knew personally George Tenet, and he confirmed to me that after he left that job, and Hoffman has gone on to do a number of things. He was an assistant U.S. attorney under Patrick Fitzgerald. He was the inspector general of the city of Chicago. He's been involved in numerous investigations as an attorney for clients. And, you know, that Hoffman, nevertheless, in the past 10 years, has met with both Tenet and Levitt on several occasions, unspecified because he won't tell me what they are. He assures me and the world that he is unbiased, but, you know, one has to ask, you know, if that's really true, and why wasn't this revealed earlier? Because it is an important and salient fact that the head of the so-called independent review of whether the APA helped the CIA construct its torture program is, in fact, a man who knew and we used to work with the head of the CIA that constructed the torture program. That doesn't seem independent to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been so long since anybody in Washington, D.C. has even heard the phrase conflict of interest. You know, the appearance of impropriety just is beyond a shadow of anything that they've ever thought about in a decade. You know, yeah. It's like, hey, I know we'll have Henry Kissinger preside over the 9/11 commission, right? Like, it's shameless, right? Because they don't even know it's shameful.
Yes, they don't. You're right. I guess that's true. Kind of hard to believe.
Yeah, that's just how we do business, Jeff. What are you talking about? This is America. It's a corrupt, fascist, torture dictatorship. You know that.
Right. Well, I don't say it's fascist, but it is a. It may be a kind of a dictatorship at this point with the NSA, and but it's not a full-fledged dictatorship yet, but it's obviously it's getting there. And
it's a participatory dictatorship.
Yes, right. That new term, yes.
Hey, I just coined it.
Self-feeding is a new term.
Some of us get to participate, and that's what makes it a free society.
No, yeah, okay. Right, exactly. And by the way, I do want to add in that the APA,
sure.
It's not just David Hoffman. The review committee that's supposed to work with Hoffman and to whom he reports have their own conflicts of interest, one of whom just stepped down, the CEO of the APA, man by the name of Norman Anderson, came under fire from a group of dissident psychologists under the rubric Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, who pointed out that this guy may be, and his office may be investigated as part of this. What's he doing on this review committee?
Right.
And so he resigned.
Oh, that's
but the other people have their own conflicts of interest. Some of them have received tens of thousands of dollars in award money from APA. One of them has. Another one has a relative who founded the division of the APA.
All right. I'm sorry. We've got to hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Jeffrey K. Dissenter.FireDogLake.com.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jeffrey K. He writes at dissenter.firedoglake.com. He's a psychologist. He, in the past, has worked with torture victims, and he's an expert on the torture beat from George W. Bush on and going back into history, too, as we're about to find out, in fact. Tell us, if you could, first of all, for this segment, Jeff, was there anything in this new torture report that you learned for the first time that really changed your understanding or helped to enhance your understanding of what went on here? I mean, obviously, you've known about the salt pit for a long time and mm-hmm. that kind of thing, but you must have learned some important things. What do you think?
There's a lot that's new I didn't know, although I don't know that I've learned anything that surprises me. So we've learned that the CIA knew beforehand what they were doing was torture. We've learned that the CIA did things that we hadn't heard about before that are just monstrous, like the so-called rectal dehydration or rehydration, i.e., kind of forced enema, kind of instrumental rape that they did on prisoners. And we learned a lot of the horror things that I think people have read in a number of articles by now. But, the CIA has done so many brutal things. I can't say these things surprise me, although they sicken me. One thing that surprised me a little, although in a way I predicted it, and this was what my most recent article was that the CIA, that the impetus for bringing Mitchell and Jessen into the interrogation picture and constructing the enhanced interrogation torture came from a not too well-known but very important entity within the CIA known as the Office of Technical Services, or OTS. And that this division had a lot to do with both setting up the torture and then vetting it legally, or so-called legally, to the office of John Yoo and other attorneys in the Office of Legal Counsel, where they set up those notorious torture memos. The data that said, oh, these techniques are safe, came from the Office of Technical Services. And one thing I didn't know that's very important is that the Office of Technical Services was the entity where James Mitchell was actually working at the time he was brought into this, which raises a lot of questions. And what your viewers may not know is, so what's this Office of Technical Services? What's the big deal? The Office of Technical Services, on one hand, is the agency that creates all the little spy gadgets that, like in a James Bond movie, the people, secret writing and poison pill capsules and, all types of spy paraphernalia, and audio listening devices, they give the bug. Oh, here's the transmitter, James Bond, turn it on when you need to be found. That comes from an office like the Office of Technical Services. But the other thing they did that they're most famous for is they were the people who ran MKUltra, the CIA's decades-long mind control program, you could call it, or torture research program, which used drugs, hypnosis, studied how to break people down psychologically and physically. It had many different aspects to it, tried to create at one point secret, you know, mind-controlled assassins, literally Manchurian candidates, according to the famous book by John Marx. And that was the Office of Technical Services. And that's the same people who were involved in the origins of the current CIA torture program. Mm-hmm. And it raises some questions as to what really this torture program is all about.
Well, you know, in different cases, you know, in Abu Ghraib, they spent a lot of time just beating the hell out of these guys and that kind of thing on that level. But you see the way they operated on Jose Padilla, for example, straight out of, you know, it didn't seem to have anything to do with the SEER training. It seemed much more like, you know, old MK Ultra stuff being done to him, psychotropic drugs and the sensory deprivation, which we find, I guess, is widespread all over the place here. But that's a very important part of what they did, right. Jose Padilla. And just really the whole O'Brien treatment from 1984, where, you know, yeah. you love me, you hate me, I'm your torturer, I'm your savior, you know, I'll kill
yeah.
you, I'm your father, and all this crap, and just drive mm-hmm. them mad,
yeah.
you know?
Yes, exactly. They want to break people down and foster dependence and to make them cooperative so they can exploit them. Everything I just said is their own language. And by exploit them, they mean to be able to, yes, sometimes get information from them. But the torture doesn't really provide information that you can rely upon. So what they're really trying to do is they're trying to get them to exploit them for other reasons. And many times one of the main reasons they do is to turn them into informants, double agents, use them for propaganda purposes, to put them on show trials like they want to do. You know, the military commissions, you know, to use them in any way they can. That's why they use the word exploit. It's not just a, you know, it's a very descriptive term. And it means to exploit them in any way they can think possible. And you know, and that includes exploit them, by the way, as some kind of experimental victim. And in the other thing, and I haven't written about this yet, but it is in the Senate torture report on the CIA, but there were discussions even within the CIA that what they were doing, if people knew about it, they could be prosecuted under the War Crimes Act for experimentation on prisoners, right?
Right.
For those of you listening, run and read page 13 of the Armed Services Senate Intelligence Committee's report. In fact, I mentioned Senate Armed Services.
You know what? Bill Mann just tweeted out an article by you and Jason Leopold from March of 2011 that addresses that exact point.
Which exact point?
It's here at truthout.org. CIA psychologist notes reveal true purpose behind Bush's torture program. But it's about the experimentation on the as a particular violation of the war crime statutes, experimentation and torture. And they have where you and Leopold had the memos here. It's on
right, but those notes were actually notes of Bruce Jessen, who along with Mitchell, you know, worked at the CIA black sites and was commissioned, you know, Mitchell and Jessen together were commissioned in late December of 2001 to write supposedly this countermeasures study on resistance to torture by Al-Qaeda off of something called the Manchester Manual that was found by British intelligence. Anyway, my point being that Mitchell and Jessen both entered the picture commissioned, again, by OTS to work on these things. So why is an agency that supposedly makes spy gadgets involved in getting Mitchell and Jessen involved in the torture program? I can't say I have a specific answer. In my latest article, I have a hypothesis, which is that, yeah, they are involved in technology, and that what they were doing was studying the physiological and psychological responses to torture, and so that they could make it more scientific, which I know sounds incredibly macabre, but that's what they do. The idea is to, you know, and there were the Physicians for Human Rights some years ago put out a report saying, hey, it looks to us like they're trying to fine-tune what torture is. This is an experiment and that this is could be prosecuted. And they tried to do it. They didn't get anywhere. But I think that there's a lot more that can be done along these lines. This isn't crazy stuff. that even in the Senate report, there's an indication that the CIA itself was worried about just exact charges of exactly those kind, and we need to know why they were so worried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it makes sense with what we know with what they did to Zubaydah and what they did, I guess, in Thailand mostly, and what they did to Khatani down at Guantanamo Bay, where you literally had at least parts of the cabinet in there in the meeting, basically with an open phone line to Guantanamo, where they're choreographing the guy's torture step by step. So make him do this, and now make him do this, and this kind of thing. Where they're trying to figure out how much pain is equivalent to organ failure. Just what can Dick Cheney argue is absolute necessary brutality to get the truth, but not really brutal. After all, it's just a slap. It's just sensory deprivation until their brain splits into a million pieces. That's not torture. Look, Judge, there's not a bruise on him. All I did was drive the man out of his mind by locking him in a coffin for 2 weeks, but I didn't pull his fingernails out.
Exactly, and that is what they call psychological or so-called touchless torture. And the prisoners who have survived that in the CIA or Guantanamo, when they talk about it to the press or to others, their attorneys, they will say, you know, the worst thing I ever experienced wasn't the beatings, right? It was the psychological torture. It was the humiliation, the sexual humiliation, the long isolation, which, by the way, is used in America's supermax prisons to break down prisoners within the United States as well, and is used currently in the Army Field Manual under the Appendix M separation technique, which is United Nations Committee Against Torture recently told the United States it had to drop that and sleep deprivation and sensory deprivation used today by Obama and his military and CIA against prisoners, not years ago, but today.
Yeah, now, hold on a second, because that's a whole can of worms, but we're already over time. So if you've got a minute, can I ask a follow-up about the Appendix M in the military? Because this is, I mean, obviously this is a whole broader subject than the very narrow focus of this CIA report, which excludes rendition, which excludes the military, and all those things, and certainly excludes the Obama years, too.
Yeah, I totally agree, but I have to be going, unfortunately. We had the half hour here.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry.
I'm really sorry, just because of my end. I'm actually working clinician still.
No problem. Patients. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll interview you hopefully sometime next week, and we can expand on that because you're one of the very, very few, as you well know, who's focusing on mistreatment, abuse, torture, enhanced, whatever the hell you call it, against prisoners in not just by, you know, Somalis working for America, but by actual American military and spies in the Obama years, too. So I'd love to interview you about that next week as a follow-up, if possible there, Jeff.
Sure, Scott. That sounds great.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Talk to you again soon. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Okay, take care.
All right, y'all, that's Jeff Kay. He's at dissenter.firedoglake.com. And the latest is SSCI report reveals CIA torture program originated in the same department as MK Ultra.